Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And, you know, folks, there's always going to be news events, things that are going to pop up in the news cycle to either distract you. Well, it's all a distraction. Because bottom line, there's nothing in the news. They will never report that we're taking back our government. They're never going to report these petitions. They're never going to report that the ground that we're actually taking back. And if they do, it'll be strictly to mock us, make fun of us, especially in those cases where we go, you know, like the your county commissioner ignores you and does nothing to challenge you to say, you know, do, you know, basically they're putting a chip on their shoulder and saying, knock it off. We dare you, because that's where our government is at. There's that emboldened. They're that enabled to believe that there's nothing we can do. And I am telling you that this is the movement, that interposition. Actually, when you put it all together, what is a petition? What is a First Amendment petition? It is an interposition by the people upon government, telling them that they're violating their oath, that they need to do what they're supposed to do or suffer the consequences. And so it only really actually takes hold. It only really takes form when we actually create the movement. This is why we need your help. I can't say it any more clear, and that's probably as succinct and concise as I could probably make it, that I think maybe even Madison might have been able to do it with less words, but nevertheless. Paul, welcome back. We're still going through the New York debates. And let me see here. We still got, I'm going to say we still have at least a day's worth of debates. Now, I will tell you that North Carolina is about as voluminous as Virginia. There's a lot in the North Carolina debates. And that's just because they really talk about and broker some subjects that we really want to dive into. And I believe one of those topics is the Mohammedan becoming president of the United States.
They cover that in the North Carolina debates?
They sure do. They sure do. And so where are we with this? We're now on June 28th, Mr. Hamilton, and if I remember correctly, let me pull it up because it only takes me a second to find the statehood order. When Virginia ratified, it was June 25th. So in other words, this is 3 days after Virginia ratified. The news had not gotten to New York yet.
Ooh, okay.
Okay. So because it takes time, right?
They did not have the internet.
They did not have the internet, nor, you know, I mean, it's a few day ride. It's several days ride from Virginia. And where was the ratification debates being held?
Was it this was North Carolina?
No, in Virginia. Virginia.
This is New York, right?
Ratification debates being held in Virginia?
Was it Richmond?
Yes. It was down in the Richmond area. So, I mean, that's a good day's ride of a horse just to get to North Virginia.
Right.
Then to get across, you know, Delaware, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, and into New Jersey was another day ride easily. To get all the way up to New York, I'm going to say it's probably 4 days ride, 5 days. As a matter of fact, Hamilton, who lived up in Mount Pilliar, which is on the northern side of Virginia, Madison, from his plantation or where his family farm was. I don't think they call it a plantation. It was a pretty humble farm. It took him 3 to 5 days just to get up to Princeton.
New Jersey,
yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So even a dedicated rider to dispatch to send the news, I don't believe that they had reached New York by the time Hamilton is speaking on the 28th of June.
Okay? Right, and they started on the 17th.
Yes.
So when they started, Virginia hadn't ratified yet.
Correct.
Okay. And as they are deliberating, Virginia finishes, I think they'd have no way of knowing.
Right. Okay. So with this, Mr. Hamilton starts talking about supreme. The word supreme, not Supreme Court necessarily, but supreme. Go ahead.
All right. I maintain that the word supreme imports no more than this, that the Constitution, the laws made in pursuance thereof, cannot be controlled or defeated by any other law. So he's talking about the Supremacy Clause. Okay?
Yes, he is. But let's keep, let's put this on the table. Common law. Common law cannot overtake or control the Constitution. So when they created this, it's almost like the Constitution became an earthly law that was supreme in all aspects regarding the livelihood and, it was a societal supreme law. Instead of making the Bible and some faith and doctrine the supreme law of the land, because that's what common law was. I mean, the Constitution becomes the supreme law, but common law becomes the supporting law of that law. This is why I'm going down a rat hole, but I talk about this. This is why we never had anybody do William Blackstone's commentaries on the law for America. Now, Joseph Story tried to do that, and Joseph Story actually admitted to, some of the perversions and some of the things that he did that weren't necessarily right, but, nevertheless, but he also admitted to how and why things were. One of the things that he admitted in his commentaries or his biography was the fact that the court system in America did not allow an atheist to actually, step into court and bear testimony. So I'm just saying, I believe, and if you look at William Blackstone, he wrote his commentaries centuries after the Magna Carta and after the Glorious Revolution, somebody finally create this compendious, document, this comprehensive view of the law for England. Well, I believe we really need some great mind to be able to do this in the real context, because if they don't do it in the real context, I'll be able to challenge them on that, right?
Right.
I mean, we all should be able to challenge them if we have the right context to our Republican form of government. So this is how, it begs the need for this, because there's way too many people today that still have too much dependency on William Blackstone's view of common law. That's the real reason I went down this rat hole, is because I run into, they're not loggerheads, there's just people that really never understood that in this new government, common law had to change and conform to the Constitution and a Republican form of government.
Right.
Right. Okay.
I think that's missed. So where did, I had an interruption while you were speaking. Where did I leave off?
Well, I would say because the interruption was so significant by me that I cut you off. Go ahead and start from the top.
Okay. So we're back in Supreme, right?
Yep, back in Supreme.
All right. I maintain that the Supreme imports no – I maintain that the word Supreme imports no more than this, that the Constitution, the laws made in pursuance thereof, cannot be controlled or defeated by any other law. The acts of the United States, therefore, will be absolutely obligatory as to all the proper objects and powers of the general government. The states as well as individuals are bound by these laws, but the laws of Congress are restricted to a certain sphere. And when they depart from this sphere, they are no longer supreme or binding. In the same manner, the states have certain independent powers in which their laws are supreme. For example, in making and executing laws concerning the punishment of certain crimes, such as murder, theft, etc., the states cannot be controlled. With respect to certain other objects, the powers of the two governments are concurrent and yet supreme. I instanced yesterday a tax on a specific article. Both might lay the tax. Both might collect it without clashing or interference. If the individual should be unable to pay both, the first seizure would hold the property. Here, the laws are not in the way of each other. They are independent and supreme.
So that's kind of interesting, because the first seizure would hold the property. In other words, if the property is gone, and then if the state actually gets to it first, then right. The state has it. So the question is, could the federal government then come to the individual? So, and actually, there's nowhere in the Constitution at this point in time where the government has the ability to actually have a direct tax on the people. The direct right. tax is upon the states.
Where did he come up with that?
Pardon me?
Where did he come up with that then?
Where did he come up with this?
With this direct idea of directly taxing the people and then, you know, having the opportunity to seize the property.
I would probably think of possibly an excise tax. But see, an excise tax is paid at the point of procurement.
Right.
So I don't know how he was laying reference to this. But bottom line, when the federal government comes to collect a tax, they're not collecting the tax actually from the people. They're receiving the payment because the state does the collection for them.
Okay.
And the concept of enforcement of taxation and everything else, as it's written in the Constitution, is dependent upon we the people. In other words, the IRS is supposed to be the militia.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if people aren't paying their fair share, then the militia has to, you know, basically get on in their cars and their trucks or whatever and drive around and say, hey, look, you know, you haven't paid your taxes. And, you know, when are you going to do this? Because bottom line, you know, if you don't pay your tax, then, you know,
we're going to have to do something.
Right. And so please make sure you get that tax paid.
Mm-hmm.
Because. And, you know, one of the things they realized was it was always hard to enforce in the system that they created. So the question is, when government actually, it's not really a question, because bottom line, the only reason government became insatiable with taxation was because it was spending on things it had no right to spend money on. And the spending actually began in the 1820s on railroads and other things like that, that they said, we need to expand into this. And so here they were spending money, but here's the interesting thing. Mm-hmm. As the federal government was actually doing this, there was more than enough capacity for people to pay out of their pockets, or I should say for the states to actually pay the taxes that the federal government was spending.
So question, and we can explore this later. I just want to throw this question out there. The federal government wasn't supposed to be spending on railroads, but railroads vastly opened up the West. So here's the question. What would have been the right way to deal with the railroads?
Well, so the right way should have actually been, and this is actually where the federal government, based on Article 1, Section 10, the federal government wasn't necessarily the only king in town. It's just that the states were constrained from being able to create compacts. And so at this point in time, the state should have realized, hey, you know what? the lateral states from New York to going across the northern states to Chicago to create a rail system, you know, we should be able, because we all benefit along this line, we mm-hmm. should all be able to, you know, contribute to develop and create this rail line.
Okay.
They would need to actually amend Article 1, Section 10 so that those northern states could do that to create not an advantage over the other states, but to develop a mutually benefiting relationship of sharing a rail line from Chicago to bringing meat to the port. And actually the union benefits, because as America sold more meats and so forth overseas, the, you know, the federal government was able to make more money in doing that.
No, now, the other option may have been to pass a constitutional amendment to support a Department of Transportation. Congress
yes.
made a bill, but every opportunity it was struck down. Tell me, why didn't they bother to try to amend the Constitution? I'm baffled by that, if they thought it was that important.
Well, so I believe that that's the divine hand of providence that, you know, sure. made that, you know, let's just use the words, you know, stiffened their necks, hardened their hearts, whatever, to say, we're not going to follow the Constitution. We're going to figure out a way to bypass it. And so in so doing, they go down this path of creating and maintaining illegitimacy. And I believe that's the divine hand of providence, because I truly believe that when it comes to domestic matters, the states would handle that best. You don't want the federal government to centralize and control all things domestic and foreign. Their responsibility is national security and foreign relations. That's all they do. So that everything else that the states could have been doing in creating strategies of, you know, their energy, food, and all of those types of things would never have even dreamed of subsidizing the production of food so that we could be dependent on foreign food sources. Subsidizing, you know, our lumber industries from becoming dependent on foreign lumber. These things just boggle my mind. The states would never have gone down that path.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how the federal government has proven that, you know, they cannot be trusted with things of our domestic strategic nature. Because mm-hmm. it's just like this concept of the federal government having food reserves and oil reserves. They've never once actually used it for the true principle it needed.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, they've actually used it against us.
Right.
So this is why all of those responsibilities are really states' responsibilities, and we need to shift those things. And people need to wake up to say, you know, we have the ability to do this for ourselves. And those states that actually can take care of their own, you know, are willing to do that, then those people will have much more affection. They'll have, you know, a better appreciation and affection towards their state government, because the state mm-hmm. is actually looking to, you know, to help benefit them if the time comes. And, you know, if the time never comes, that's great. But it's better to have and not need than to need and not have. Right? So,
yep.
Anyway, so I think that that's really the important takeaway, that we, you know, when we look at, you know, all of this that, you know, that the federal government is doing or has been assuming, you know, the states should have done that. Absolutely. The states should have worked it out. They should have come to this conclusion. We need to change Article 1, Section 10. To allow us to do things, but we need to do it so that we don't create a separate taxation. We need to make it, because this is where you can actually create a symbiotic relationship between the federal taxation and the funding of domestic issues, because the states would just basically send off, okay, here's our budget, you know, collect the taxes for this, We will operate. We will maintain the strategy. We will have all the controls. And you have the responsibility of taxing. And when all the states agree that that becomes a vehicle mechanism or a taxation vehicle in the federal government, okay, now it just basically is going to support the needs of this. But how we would design that and contain that, we could do a really smart job in making sure that the, you know, this new Department of Energy or this Congress of Energy does not actually get away with stealing, you know, everything from us like the federal government has been doing.
Okay.
And by isolating these into separate polities is by far the better design, because when you actually have all of these different polities, you know, right now, if somebody dropped a bomb on Washington, D.C., if Washington, D.C. was blown away, we would be crippled as a nation because all of our dependency comes from there. But if we actually had our polities in Omaha and throughout the union, because our infrastructure was somewhere else, our energy was somewhere else, our education was somewhere else, we wouldn't be completely knocked out.
Right.
It would be a strategic, you know, placement throughout the union. And all of these different areas and regions of the union would benefit by having that small polity in Omaha or that polity in Texas or in Montana. You know, and that's how we could actually help develop those parts of the union by creating polities out in these really diverse areas, like right. like the Dakotas.
Sure.
Anyway, right. Okay, so I digress. So the next comment that comes out of Hamilton is regarding taxation. So, and we've got 2.5 minutes, so I don't know if we actually have the time, but just go ahead and kind of read until I kind of interrupt. Okay.
All right, just let me know. Okay. I shall proceed now more particularly to the proposition before the committee. This clearly admits that the unlimited power of taxation, which I've been contending for, is proper. It declares that after the states have refused to comply with the requisitions, the general government may enforce its demands. When the gentleman's proposition and principle admit this in its fullest latitude, the whole course of the states is against it. The mode they point out would involve many inconveniences against which they would wish to guard. Suppose the gentleman's scheme should be adopted. Would not all the resources of the country be equally in the power of Congress? The states can have but one opportunity of refusal. After having passed through the empty ceremony of a requisition, the general government can enforce all its demands without limitation or resistance. The states will either comply or they will not. If they comply, they are bound to collect the whole of the tax from the citizens. The people must pay it. Then will be the disadvantage of its being levied and collected by Congress in the first instance. It has been proved, as far as probabilities can go, that the federal government will, in general, take the laws of the several states as its rule and pursues those measures to which the people are most accustomed. But if the states do not comply, what is the consequence? If the power of compulsion be a misfortune to the state, they must now suffer it without opposition or complaint. I shall show, too, that they must feel it in an aggravated degree. It may frequently happen that though the states formally comply with the requisitions, the avails will not be fully realized by Congress. The states may be dilatory in the collection and payment and may form excuses for not paying the whole. There may be also a partial compliances which will subject to the union to inconveniences. Congress, therefore, in laying the tax, will calculate for these losses and inconveniences. They will make allowances for the delays and delinquencies of the states and apportion their burdens accordingly. They will be induced to demand more than their actual wants.
Okay, so he's basically laying out that it's not necessarily this, you know, truly brute force, but there may be delays. There may be reasons for that, and they will have to either come up with interest rates or those types of things to come up with. Okay, so because you couldn't do this, then this is the consequence. So, folks, we're going to go into a break. Paul will be right back because as we, you know, hit this break time, we will actually go, I'll let you all ponder on this whole taxation thing, what Hamilton is basically laying out. But bottom line you know, this system actually did work. And when we looked at the how the system worked, it worked so well that, like I was saying, that the federal government actually started spending money. They realized that they could actually spend money and start benefiting, and the states allowed them to violate this. We'll be right back after this.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so during Madison's veto of the bonus bill of 1817, he made a point that even if the states allow the federal government, so when the federal government comes along with money, they say, we're going to do these things, and you're going to benefit off of this. Even when the states allow that, and every state in the union benefits off of it, it still does not make it legitimate. The only way it can be legitimate is via the, you know, via the Article 5 process. Now, when the federal government, so just to be clear here, when the federal government started doing these things, when they started, you know, giving the states money to say, we need you to do this, we've created these labor laws and we want you to enforce these, we've, you know, we had this act, all of these things were not predicated upon duplicity. In other words, a collusion of a conspiracy between the states and the federal government. This all established that the federal government asserted the authority by passing the act and then basically told the states they had to do it. Does that make sense, Paul? Now, you may be muted right now. So anyway, are you?
Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you now. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, yeah. That's an interesting position that they've taken, and they're apparently still doing that, and the states are eating it up.
But so the initial break through the levy was done based on the assertion that they had the legitimate authority. These were the arguments that Marshall made. Marshall made the arguments that the federal government was supreme in all things it deemed necessary and proper. I mean, he started marrying these clauses that actually created portals that absolutely violated the essence of the Constitution and its limited powers, roles, responsibilities, and property. And therefore, when they started doing this, then that became the mode of operation. And over time, the states just became the recipients of more and more money as the federal government sought more control. Now, it was a very slow process from the 1820s, you know, to the Department of Interior, to the Department of Agriculture, to, I believe, the next departments that were formed were Justice, and then Commerce and Labor was formed under, I think, Teddy Roosevelt. And so as we started, you know, as they started growing, the increase in government's insatiable desire to control more and more aspects of and govern us in more ways, such as labor, such as education, such as health, and all of these types of things, they started invoking these acts, and the states never, because they'd already said, well, they told us they had the ability to do this. The courts even ruled in their own favor. due to the, and this is the key here, due to the illiteracy of the people of the Union and not understanding the Constitution, they didn't know how to fight. Nobody understood the resolutions of 1798. Nobody understood Madison's report. Folks, it only came forth out of these, I'll just say, the last days here. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this stuff didn't, I mean, I remember struggling and, you know, praying with my father, you know, how can we fix this? And it wasn't that clear. I mean, it was, you know, document upon document, you know, the concept of line upon line or precept upon precept, the, as it built and slowly, you know, was basically unfolded, we clearly could see now how, you know, the wool had slowly been pulled over the Republic's eyes and how they started doing things. By the time they got to the Organic Act, you know, the evil die was cast. Mm-hmm. And we were now basically, I shouldn't even say it wasn't legitimately cast. In other words, they may have used super glue or what have you, but it does not even affect or blemish the surface of the Constitution. As long as we have the Constitution, we can restore it. As a, we have the authority to basically resurrect this constitutional republic.
Correct.
And there's nothing that can stop us in doing that. We have all the power and authority. The Constitution gives us these things. And to me, that right there is the amazing thing that we have, because there's no nation in the world that can allow you to get back to where you were. This is the only one.
Wow, that's amazing. That's just straight up amazing.
So, anyway, these are just GRisms, or, you know, as I suffer through, you know, understanding what we're doing and everything else. It's important to, you know, share these insights. It's important to help you understand that, you know, We're only here because we're allowing ourselves to be here. It's just like that Lord of Rings metaphor, where all you have to do is wake up under the, because we're under a spell. You know, we believe we're trapped. We're not trapped. Mm-hmm. All we have to do is say, hold, the Constitution doesn't give you the authority. It gives us the authority to actually do these things and to take this country back.
Right. That's amazing.
Yes.
So I just noticed something, GR.
Yes.
We don't have that many more references in the New York debates to go.
Oh, no. That's why I said we probably got today and maybe, you know, one more day after today. Right. You're absolutely correct.
All right.
Okay.
So right now it looks like we're on Mr. Treadwell and martial law. Is that right?
That is correct. And then exclusive legislation. That is correct.
Okay. So here we go. Why is it said that the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless, in cases of rebellion or invasion, the public safety may require it? What clause in the Constitution, except this very clause itself, gives the general government a power to deprive us of that great privilege, so sacredly secured to us by our state constitutions? Why is it provided that no bill of attainder shall be passed, or that no title of nobility shall be granted? Are there any clauses in the Constitution extending the powers of the general government to these objects? Some gentlemen say that these, though not necessary, were inserted for greater caution. I could have wished, sir, that a greater caution had been used to secure to us the freedom of election, a sufficient and responsible representation, the freedom of the press, and a trial by jury, both in civil and criminal cases.
Ah, and then what the next obvious thing would be is, you know, a free labor market or the abolishment of slavery. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that, you know, we have to, you know, we have to all agree upon, because having just read a couple of weeks ago the Declaration of Independence, the actual declaration versus the politically correct, that even in the Continental Congress, as we were standing up to actually, before we declared independence to fight a revolutionary war, we already were in the throes of political correctness. And correct. So there's always going to be the need of compromise when you're in these states. In other words, when you're in this point of trying to create this fundamental document, these fundamental, you know, how do we enact these principles in this governing? But once it's done, this the die is cast. It's done. And folks, it's done. And I believe regardless of the compromises that they did make, those things are nothing now. The only reason that there's something is because people want to make political hay and be divisive over slavery. People want to make these things a issue so that they can divide and conquer us. I can't tell you how divided these men were over their faith and religion. The Puritans were the worst because they looked at all these other people as heathens.
Mm.
And, you know, there were obviously these other faiths coming up. And there were, you know, but when it came to religion, that and labor, those were two very, very hardcore. Folks, we don't have that problem anymore. We shouldn't have these problems anymore. Why is it that we allow these things to continually fester and allow them to divide us?
Right.
And so when we see people bringing up these types of things, then we can actually say, you know what? And we could point the finger of judgment at these people and say, look, all you're doing is you're trying to divide us so that you can control us. Because that is always the inevitable outcome. When people try to use division, it is all the outcome is to control.
Right.
Okay, so go ahead.
You had mentioned something about mentioning Mohammedans. Is this where we're going to hear this?
No. This is that'll be the North Carolina debates. We haven't got to that yet.
Sorry. So we're in exclusive legislation, I think.
Yes, correct.
Okay. The plan of the federal city, sir, departs from every principle of freedom. Is he talking about Washington, D.C.?
Well, so the federal city has not been agreed upon yet. Right. In the Constitution, the states have to accede a separate. And so one of the things that, you know, was part of the discussion is obviously you couldn't create a donut. In other words, the last thing you wanted to do was actually put Washington, D.C. surrounded by a state.
Right.
In other words, it really needed to be. And ideally, the best place would have been in between two states on the coast.
Okay.
Because then there would be direct access in and out to Washington, D.C. that the states would not have any control over.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Because how do you get to Washington, D.C. back in the old days? Well, you either navigate up the Potomac to get to it, so foreign emissaries could actually go straight into Washington, D.C., or you'd have to, you know, land at a port and then ride a buggy from Norfolk or from, you know, a northern port like Pennsylvania or so forth and come south. So you'd have to traverse through states, right?
Okay. All right, here we go. The plan of the federal city, sirs, departs from every principle of freedom as far as the distance of the two polar stars from each other.
for subjecting the inhabitants of that district to the exclusive legislation of Congress, in whose appointment they have no share or vote, is laying a foundation on which may be erected as complete a tyranny as can be found in the Eastern world. Nor do I see how this evil can possibly be prevented without raising the foundation of this happy place where men are to live without labor upon the fruit of the labors of others. This political hive where all the drones in the society are to be collected to feed on the honey of the land. How dangerous this city may be and what its operation on the general liberties of this country, time alone must discover. But I pray God it may not prove to this Western world what the city of Rome, enjoying a similar constitution, did to the Eastern. But he's pretty flowery here and pretty animated.
Yep.
There's another clause. Yeah, there's another clause in this constitution which, though there is no prospect of getting it amended, I think ought not to be passed over in silence, lest such a silence should be construed into a tacit approbation of it. I mean the clause which restricts the general government from putting a stop for a number of years to a commerce which is a stain to the commerce of any civilized nation and has already blackened half the plains of America with a race of wretches made so by our cruel policy of avarice, and which appears to me to be already repugnant to every principle of humanity, morality, religion, and good policy. There are other objections to this Constitution which are weighty and unanswerable, but they have been so clearly stated and so fully debated in the course of this discussion that it would be an unjustifiable intrusion on the patience of the House to repeat them. I shall therefore content myself with a few observations on the general plan and tendency. We are told that this is a federal government. I think, sir, there is as much propriety in the name as in that which its advocates assume. Hang on.
Uh-huh.
And no more. It is in my idea as complete a consolidation as the government of this state, in which legislative powers to a certain extent are exercised by the several towns and corporations. The sole difference between a state government under this constitution and a corporation under a state government is that a state being more extensive than a town, its powers are likewise proportionably extended. But neither of them enjoys the least share of sovereignty. For let me ask, what is a state government? What sovereignty? What power is left to it? When the control of every source of revenue and the total command of the militia are given to the general government.
Now, so obviously Treadwell is making some good points, but again, on the point of the militia, does the federal government possess the authority over the militia? No. Only when it is time to execute the laws of the Union or to suppress insurrections or to repel invasions do they have the power to call them forth. So in other words, the militia is for the states to have and maintain, and they're to rely upon the federal government for the standards, training, and equipping of the militia. So in other words, there needed to be a budget for, you know, giving and making sure that the states maintain a good, viable militia. And so, you know, as you go through all of these points that he's bringing up and talking, obviously he brought up slavery.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of brushed over it. They didn't say slavery, but he talked about the cruel polity, you know, these policies of, you know, shutting down for a number of years to a commerce, which is a stain to the commerce of any civilized nation. And
he
so,
chose not to use the S word.
Yeah, he chose not to use that. But bottom line, he's saying, you know, he wanted to see it done immediately.
Right.
And again, so rightfully so, I think that there were men that complained about the political correctness that came out of the Constitution. But the Constitution had it right. Because bottom line, we have a hardcore document that actually, you know, clarified, you know, that the paradigm was wrong of the South. You know, just the three-fifths rule. The South claimed that this was property, but they also tried to have, you know, they tried to butter their bread on the other side by saying these are people that deserve, and the rest of the state said you can't have it both ways. You don't get full apportionment because you're still treating these as property. These folks are not property. We'll give you three-fifths, but until you change, you're not getting full apportionment. So they drew that line. Does that make sense?
It does. Well, kind of. But the other thing that still gets me is these people weren't being represented. So why should they get any apportionment for it? You know?
It kind of heads down the damned if you do, damned if you don't, right?
Yeah, I guess that's the best way to put it. Yeah,
right, because bottom line, had they basically said, no, they are property, you get no apportionment, then it doesn't mm-hmm. create the discussion at all. But the fact that they actually split and said, we believe they deserve it, but because you label them as property, you don't get full apportionment.
Okay.
Now, to be clear, nobody actually has, not all citizens had apportionment or representation.
You had to be a landowner.
You had to be a landowner, and you had to pay your poll tax. So, in other words, you had to be willing, you know, to be paying and being a part of the system, you know, as a productive part of the system to be able to participate.
Correct.
Right, wrong, or indifferent. Right, wrong, or indifferent. They at least had it so that they didn't allow, you know, as we can see, those who just want to game the system and give themselves their daily bread by the hand of government because they don't want to work, you know, that is how we kind of corrupt our, you know, that's how democracies fall. The Tytler cycle of democracy proves this. But our Constitution constrained our government from being able to even hand out a scintilla of bread. And so, when we look at the elections and so forth, they had all of these different, these were actually checks and balances to make sure that somebody had skin in the game to make sure that we maintained a good, honorable system. But I think that most people didn't realize, but I think the reality was, because there's the two sides, most people didn't realize that they couldn't do these things. But I think that these guys were wise enough to go, they're going to find ways to abuse these things like they did. They're going to find, when I say find ways, they're going to find a judge. They're going to get somebody in, an ideologue, that is actually going to try to befuddle people. And it happens when you least expect it, which is why John Marshall was, you know, I think the pivotal guy to create these, I'll just say these weaknesses in the levees, or these holes in the levees, to eventually drain the state's powers, where the federal government was kind of contained by these levees, and they started poking holes with, you know, saying, oh, well, we can do these things. We have these authorities. And then later on, when they started injecting case law and precedents, which was not, you know, not granted in the Constitution that they could do those things, then they said, hey, well, he said we could do it, so we can do it. And that's how they aggrandized themselves. So it's not a good thing. But bottom line is, everything is all traceable down to, you know, when you look at the constitutional forensics, I guess, of the science of forensics, you can actually see what and how each of these, you know, blows to the Constitution, or the blows to these barriers in the Constitution, and how they served over time to where we now actually have the Supreme Court saying, hey, everybody in the world is entitled to a piece of bread from the United States.
Right.
Right. when that's not true? That's not even a delegated role, responsibility, power, or property for them to possess bread or give it, let alone hand it out. Anyway.
So how much time do we have?
We got about just less than 4 minutes. So we got enough to cover this last comment on exclusive legislation and wrap up.
All right, here we go.
Now, this is a resolution that they wanted to contain this, and I thought it was worth noting. Go ahead.
All right, so actually that may be resolved as the opinion of this committee that the right of the Congress to exercise exclusive legislation over such district not exceeding 10 miles square as in May by secession of particular states and the acceptance of Congress become the seat of the government of the United States shall not be so exercised as to exempt the inhabitants of such district from paying the same taxes, duties, imposts, and excises so shall be imposed on the other inhabitants of the state where such district may be, nor shall it be so exercised as to prevent the laws of the state and all processes under those laws from extending to such district in all cases of crimes committed without the district or in cases of contracts made between persons residing within such districts and persons residing without it. Nor shall it be so exercised as to authorize any inhabitant of the said district to bring any suit in any court may be established by the Congress within the same against any citizen or person not an inhabitant of said district. And it is understood that the stipulations in this Constitution respecting all essential rights shall extend as well to this district as to the United States in general. Resolved further as the opinion of this committee that the right of exclusive legislation with respect to such places as may be purchased for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, and dockyards and other needful buildings shall not be construed to authorize Congress to make any law to prevent the laws of the states in which they may lie from extending to such places in all civil and criminal matters, except as to such persons as shall be in the service of the United States, nor to them with respect to crimes committed without such purpose.
So here's an interesting thing. What they were basically trying, and this was something that they wanted to amend to the Constitution, and actually it kind of exposes, you know, those people who live within the district have some immunities from taxations that the states were actually to have, right? And right. But they also didn't have representation. So, in other words, you know, the people that lived there, they may have been able to keep all their money, but they couldn't vote. And that was the consequence of being there. And everybody trying to basically remove the consequences of their decisions have really, you know, bent over backwards to try to, you know, get their bread buttered on all sides, not just the front and back, but all the edges too. And so it's the human nature that we always pursue those types of things. But here's the interesting thing, that clearly they couldn't do those types of things like creating laws or exercising laws that were outside of that district where Biden start saying, well, we're going to start performing abortions in states on our military facilities. He can't do that. The military and what it does in its role and function is not to provide abortions for the people of a state. And so what he was basically doing would, they defined this, that they would be limited, but they clearly it wasn't granted either. You don't have to worry about limiting if it's not granted. And it clearly wasn't granted. Thank you again, Paul. We'll be back with you next week with North Carolina. Folks, we got to go. And so with that, we'll be back tomorrow with Feedback Friday. As you can tell, you know, we're going through the ratification debates with as much, you know, speed as we possibly can. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, health care, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty.